every time we put up big adverts that were sponsored by the UK government, actually people took the opposite approach because they were more worried about government potentially following them around or keeping tabs on them. One of the things that I decided to do was actually pivot the money from advertising and spend it more on community engagement.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy. And I believe that the best way you can get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Henry Gregg, the Director of External Affairs at Asthma and Lung UK. AL UK is one of the UK's leading charities tackling the root causes of asthma and other respiratory conditions. Before joining AL UK, he had communications roles at Circle Housing, Newham Council and the National Housing Federation. At the start of his career, he worked with three different MPs as a press officer, including the current Minister for Nature, Mary Cray MP. Henry, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks very much.
Can you just start by just telling us about your journey to where you are today?
Sure. So it had quite a varied career, actually. As you mentioned, started off working for MPs, which was really interesting, both in the constituency and in Parliament, during which time I actually got a copy of the original dodgy dossier for Iraq. Unfortunately, I didn't take it home because that might actually be a criminal offence, but I did have the copy of it, and I always regret not keeping hold of it because it would have been a good thing to show the kids and the grandkids. The one that said that Iraq could attack within 45 minutes. But yeah, in case any police are listening, I don't actually have a copy in my house, so you don't need to come around and arrest me.
I know that very well because my wife, Clodagh, got the dodgy dossier when she was a journalist, and she was...
Did she?
She was the one that broke the story of the dodgy dossier.
Oh, wow. So you probably definitely do have a copy at home. So yeah, worked for three different MPs. Then I did 13 years in housing, campaigning for more social housing, both at the National Housing Federation and also working at a housing association as well, which was really interesting, and spent the last year of that working a lot on the Grenfell disaster. Then did a year in the private sector representing retailers and landlords in the West End. And then I worked in Newham during COVID, which was really interesting, but also obviously quite heavy duty because it was the most had the most deaths of any local authority area in the country in Newham. So that was did a lot of work on, I did all of the comms for the COVID-19 app. If you remember that app that you used to download, and it used to tell you to take the day off work if you'd met anyone else with COVID. So we trialed that in Newham, and it was also trialed in the Isle of Wight, so that was interesting. And then Health Foundation, and then also Barking and Dagenham Council. So yeah, a range of kind of private sector, but also local government and charities and housing. And I guess what pulls the whole thing together is the gold dust for me is actually achieving legislative change and achieving policy change. That's kind of what gets me out of bed in the morning. And I've been lucky enough to been able to do that on a few occasions. And that's what really gets me going.
Great. So just tell us a bit about AL UK. What does it do and what do you do for it?
Sure. So it represents the one in five people who will have a lung condition in their lifetimes. It's about 12 million people, and that includes asthma, also chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, and lots of lung cancer and all the other lung conditions. What I do is I'm Director of External Affairs. So I look after our media and social media, our health policy. We're also the main organization that campaigns for clean air in the UK as well, because of its effect on people with lung conditions. And then I'm also responsible for our influencing of the UK government and devolved nations. So doing a lot of work at the moment on trying to get into the NHS 10-year plan, but we're also doing a lot of work at the moment on tobacco and vapes bill. So we're essentially going to hopefully ban cigarettes for anyone born after 2009 forever, which could be quite a big move. So that's currently what I'm working on.
Yeah, so I'm quite pleased that my own children will never legally be allowed to smoke, even when they're 75, 80, 90
years
old.
My daughter's absolutely, yeah, is a big anti-smoking campaigner. And I actually took her down to my local MP's office because she's the Lib Dem health spokesperson in St Albans. And she, was a really, really passionate advocate for it. So there we go. I'm getting my children involved in the campaign as well.
You are? How old is she?
She's 11. Yeah. So she's not quite got into teenage years, so maybe she'll be less health conscious when she's a teenager. We'll see.
Is she in secondary school yet or still in primary
school?
Not yet.
Next year. So something to look forward to.
Exciting stuff, yeah. And one of the areas that all of us that campaign in air pollution are very aware of is one of the biggest kind of stick. And for those listening that don't really know about carrots and sticks when it comes to policy, a carrot policy is one that draws you towards it, which is a positive behavior change. And a stick is generally one that's a negative one that stops you from doing things. The ultra low emission zone in London is a daily charge for those driving in London with a vehicle that doesn't meet the ultra low emission zone standards. And there's a lot of hot feeling riding on that because a lot of people do use their vehicle for their job. They need to get around and they feel punished on that. So it's one that in London in particular, but you do get ultra low emission zones in cities around the world. But in London, it's a topic that's such a hot one that both the two main parties in the UK have almost taken opposite sides on this one and won and lost MPs on it. But it's one that I'm sure affects you. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so as I say, we're one of the biggest campaigners on clean air. We're a big supporter of you, Les. One of the things that meant was that, for example, when I'm at home listening to Heart with my kids, which they subject me for hours and hours, occasionally my chief exec would come up on Heart and say, "Hey, I'm the chief exec of Aspen Lung UK, and we love you. We support you, Les, because it helps young people's lungs." And following that, we'd get an absolute barrage of people from generally white van drivers on our social media channels attacking us and full of expletives and various suggestions for what we could do with our policy. So it was quite challenging to operate in that space because the feelings are so strong. And in fact, when I was working in local government, it's the only thing that people would actually protest in Barking and Dagenham. The only thing people would do protests on was ULEZ, basically, outside of the city hall. So yeah, definitely always gets a lot of social media activity on that one.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as you know, we've been working with different organisations on clean air and trying to clean up the UK's air in particular. Are there any of the campaigns that we've worked on and with or clients that we've worked with that you particularly admire?
Yeah, I think Clean Cities campaign is a really effective one, especially the one looking at, unfortunately, it looks like some of the incentives for clean vehicles in London are going to be taken away, which seems completely at odds with what Sadiq Khan and the GLA are trying to achieve in London. So yeah, we've also joined that campaign, which I know you've been involved in, John, to try and make sure that people continue to get those incentives and actually that we don't go backwards increase the pollution in London because it's moving in the right direction, but we've got to keep fighting for it.
Yeah, so if you don't know about the ins and out of that, and if you're a listener and you don't expect you to, but as essentially about a year from now, at the end of next year, there's a current exemption if you've got an electric vehicle or a vehicle that doesn't pollute at the point of the car. Obviously, the electricity needs to be green electricity, not to pollute anywhere in the world, but certainly at the point of the car, which affects air in London, you have an exemption from paying the ULEZ charge. At the end of next year, that is due to be abolished. And if you've invested in a electric vehicle, and lots of you all know that electric vehicles cost more money at the moment than a petrol or diesel vehicle, it will essentially pay the same amount as a diesel vehicle. So there'll be a disincentive to investing that extra money in electric vehicles if we don't get that change. So as Henry said, Higginson's strategy is supporting Clean Cities with a campaign to try and get the Mayor of London City, Khan, to extend that extension. Extend that exemption. And it just seems absolutely right that that's done, but it hasn't been announced yet, and we're pushing hard to try and make that happen. What's been one of your biggest communications wins over the years?
I'd say probably the main one was over the 13 years I worked in social housing, was getting housing from a kind of really niche political issue that was only really covered in Guardian Society at best, kind of right onto the front pages. I think when I started working there, it was the 10th or 11th biggest electoral issue. And by the time we'd finished, it had gone up to third or fourth nationally, but was actually the number one electoral issue in London. With lots of campaigns on things like the bedroom tax, but also, you know, just the lack of housing that was being built, the cost of housing, we managed to raise it up the agenda quite a lot, and then got quite a bit of money, firstly from the Labour government. So back under Gordon Brown's time, we got £8.4 billion for new housing, new social housing, and then actually it probably even more significantly under the coalition government, because people weren't really expecting them to spend money on social housing. So the fact that they committed to social housing was really positive. There's still not enough housing built, and actually there's been no money committed from the new government yet, very little. But yeah, getting housing on the agenda was quite a big challenge.
And it goes to show, doesn't it, that communications is not just words. Those are billions of pounds worth of money that come on the back of those words and rising up the agenda. And it feels now that housing, you know, has never not been at the top of the agenda. It seems almost weird to think that it was down at 8th, 9th, 10th position below all these other issues. Because now it's in every paper all the time. It goes to show that, you know, having conversations opens up other conversations, which opens up budgets and wallets and helps people in their lives in massive ways. What's been one of the kind of biggest challenges of your career?
I would say probably the biggest challenge in terms of a communications challenge was when I was in Newham. We agreed to try. So Newham was the hardest hit, as I mentioned earlier, local authority area under COVID. We had more deaths than anywhere else, partly just because of the demographics. It's the most diverse local authority area in the country as well, and one of the poorest. And we agreed to trial the COVID-19 app. If you don't remember, the COVID-19 app is the thing that everyone downloaded, and basically, if you came into contact with anyone else with COVID, it would ping you, and you'd have to stay home for a number of days. So it was us and the Isle of Wight, but you couldn't really get anywhere more different from Newham than the Isle of Wight. Obviously, you know, that's an island, quite rural, not that densely populated. And essentially, the challenge was that. Because of their experiences of COVID, the local population didn't want to play ball at all with the government. They were very mistrustful of the government. And what we found, the government threw a whole load of money at it. So I had lots of money for outdoor spend. And what I found is that every time we put up big adverts that were sponsored by the UK government, actually people took the opposite approach and wanted to download the app less, because they were more worried about kind of government potentially following them around or keeping tabs on them. So one of the things that I decided to do was actually pivot the money from advertising and big kind of social media advertising, and spend it more on community engagement. So getting people to go into mosques, community centres, and explain that, you know, this was hurting and killing their local communities, and actually to protect their local communities, they needed to download this app, which was a lot more effective. But it was really tough, I mean, especially as a lot of people in Newham work cash in hand jobs and jobs that they can't afford to take time away from. So persuading them to download the app was a real challenge.
That's a really interesting one. And actually, engagement is an area professionally in communications that is a bit of a backwater. People don't think of it nearly as much as they think of other things. And we talk about the message far more than we talk about the messenger. And in this example, you know, when the messenger is a government and people aren't trusting the government and they don't know what's going on, then suddenly the messenger becomes far more valuable than the message itself. You know, you're talking about
absolutely
delivering the same message through two different means. And I think as we go on, the messenger is going to start becoming more and more valuable again. I think we probably had a period in which it almost felt for a while like it didn't matter where the message came from, you just accepted it as truth. And now far more lies are coming through in lots of different areas of things. And so communications channels that are trusted are going to be far, far more valuable than they were in the past.
And actually on that, John, one really good example is one of the things I found out as part of this project was that the guy who was responsible for developing the app was actually an Asian guy from a nearby council, but his parents and his uncle actually were from Newham, and they were local business areas in the local area. So we did a whole kind of local story about this guy who had grown up with his family in Newham and essentially was now the person fronting the app, which was a really good way of humanizing it and making it seem like this isn't a big tech company or government kind of clamping down on people. It's actually someone whose family are in Newham, who grew up in Newham and is actually now developing this app. So that was quite helpful actually in terms of making it seem less scary and less kind of corporate.
That's great. And if people don't know Newham, it's got a very large Southeast Asian community, doesn't it? Lots of people from Bangladesh. Yeah. And so, you know, with areas where you've got very large immigrant populations, quite often those are the routes for information where actually trust in government is far less, where government is seen as something that will potentially come into your house and take you away and send you to another country. You can see why people in those communities have a lower level of trust of government when that's what government will represent. You know, when people in their community might come in through illegal means or anything else, there's clearly going to be a lower level of trust of government when you spend your life with your, you know, looking over your shoulder, wondering when the government's going to come along and what they're going to do. What do you do to unwind?
That's a good question. So during COVID, when we couldn't get out to gyms and so forth, I started doing a sort of daily exercise regime that takes about half an hour. And it's basically kind of you do a lot of repetitions of different exercises with weights and so forth for half an hour. And I find that's been really useful, actually. I've kept it going since COVID. I try to do it in the mornings, but my kids have kind of seem to be getting up earlier and earlier and being more and more chaotic. So sometimes I've had to switch to the evening. But, yeah, it's a really good way of getting the day started. And also, I think if you're working from home, some days I realize, you know, I haven't really been out for a walk much or done any exercise, especially if you've got back-to-back Zoom meetings. So I find that's a good way. I really, really try to carve out that half an hour to do that exercise every day.
Great. Well, that's it. It's forming a habit and sticking to it is that's the hardest bit. That's where we all struggle. So well done that you've kept at that. What kind of media do you find most effective?
In terms of reading or in terms of getting out there?
Well, you've given a good example, actually, of community engagement being a good media. But yeah, why don't you give me both? The ones in terms for professionally, what you found most useful and what you like to read yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think professionally, what we've actually found at Asmund Lung UK is we found using consumer media has been really helpful in terms of getting storytellers' stories out there. I mean, things like you know, asthma and COPD are generally stories of, you know, children, younger people, and older people who've had asthma attacks or whatever that can be either life threatening or fatal. And I think if you put those people in front of the cameras, that speaks volumes, and sometimes is a lot more effective than I don't know, a chief exec or whatever, because it brings the story to life and it generally makes people empathize with it more. So I think where we've really tried to do that in terms of our broadcast, but also our consumer media, and got people like Bill Bailey, who has asthma, to talk about his experiences and stuff like that. And I think that just helps to humanize and connect with people in a way that sometimes the stats and the sort of more policy side doesn't resonate as much. And then, yeah, from a personal perspective, I'm sort of finding X less and less, or Twitter less and less kind of appealing at the moment. So for me, yeah, I think I've been trying to get some alternative media. So yeah, reading more blogs and trying to spend a lot of time sort of reading political commentators, individual sort of Substacks and stuff, just to get a bit more of that interesting analysis.
Brilliant. What message would you give to your younger self?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it would be to get less sucked into the day-to-day and try to keep an eye on the sort of what the longer term gains. I guess what I mean by that is, for me, what I discovered over time was the gold dust for me is changing the law, changing a policy. For example, in my job with Mary Cray, we managed to ban junk food from all vending machines in schools, which is the first time I really got a proper legislative change. It was from, I think it was Ruth Kelly at the time, who was education secretary. And that was just it for me. I was like, right, this is what I want to do with my career, is change the law and change things.
Was that around the time of Jamie Oliver's school
yes.
meal stuff?
Yeah, it was. It was riding on the back of the school meals campaign that Jamie Oliver did. And we did a private members bill to take junk food out of vending machines, and the government agreed to it, which was great. So, but yeah, that's some kind of what I focus on. And I think you can get sucked into the sort of daily sort of tasks and the politics and all of that. But I think if you're a campaigner, you've got to just keep your eye on what really makes a difference. Is, are you actually getting that final change, whether it's legislative or policy?
Yeah, well, I remember that very well, Jamie's school dinners, it was called.
And, yes, that's right.
And the
turkey Twizzlers, I think, yeah.
Turkey Twizzlers. And he actually went into my school, the school that I went
Did
to
he?
In Southeast London. And the worst thing about it, and it was a perfectly good school, but it was in a kind of a poor area of London. And one of the few things that the parents ever got het up about was that he was serving healthy food to their kids, and they'd come along to the school gate.
Oh yeah, and they passed burgers. They passed burgers through the railings.
Yeah, and you kind of think,
so it wasn't your parents chucking the burgers over the railings?
It wasn't my mum and dad chucking them over the railings. But I mean, that really does show something, doesn't it?
Yeah, remember that. It was a real seminal moment where you think, God,
if the only
he's trying to do his best, get the veggies in, and they're chucking burgers over the railings.
Exactly. And if the only time you get involved with your school is not to join the PTA and do these things, no, it's to give your kids junk food instead of being given healthy food. That was a really good example, actually, of, you know, sometimes TV programs can really catch the zeitgeist of the nation, and then you can use those to get things through. So that's a good example. A more recent one is the post office scandal, which led from a great TV program. And you often need those things. Often there's big problems that everyone knows about, but you need one or two things, and you need something that is popular. And often the popular things come on TV or through
we were trying to, as part of that campaign, ban junk food advertising for children, and that debate is still going on now, like 20 years later or whatever it is, because they're still advertising junk food to children, although the current government has said it's going to now finally legislate on that, so we'll see.
Okay. Finally, if you could have one dinner with anyone alive or dead, who would it be and why?
So I think it would be Gandhi, which sounds a bit of an obvious one, but actually the reason I would choose him is I think he's probably like the most successful campaigner of all time. If you think about where power lies, persuading the British government to sort of walk out of India and give it up as a colonial power is quite a big feat. How he managed to achieve that, and I guess shows that you'd think in that environment that you'd need like military power in order to achieve that, and actually achieved it through essentially kind of persuading people not to work with the British government. But it just sort of shows that, yeah, what you can achieve basically, even if the odds are stacked against you. So I would be interested to find out how he went about achieving that.
Yeah, and then also I suppose by not fighting back, it showed the excessive brutality of the exactly. British Empire, which then the British people couldn't tolerate for themselves. They thought, sorry, I can't accept this. But, you know, if they saw through the media, you know, all these clashes and both sides were fighting, and they could have been sold a story that was, you know, of both sides fighting. But through the means that he took, that story couldn't be changed in any way. It was clearly a
peaceful,
you know, violence against peace, and that changed the mind of the British people as well. And once the British people's minds were changed, I think that really led to that change there. Henry Gregg, Director of External Affairs at Asthma and Lung UK. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson Strategy supports purpose-led organisations, please visit higginsonstrategy.com.